You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we take a look at conflicts over large industrial livestock farms in small Wisconsin communities and find out how local governments are working to regulate those operations. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about an iconic and prolific director.
The movies of Michael Schultz, like Cooley High, Car Wash, and Crush Groove, have given joy, drama, and great jams to millions around the world. The Milwaukee native was one of the first and most successful directors in Hollywood to bring the lives of Black Americans to the forefront of his films. Andy Turner recently talked to Schultz, who's now 83 years old, about his Milwaukee roots and long career, which continues today.
Michael Schultz has been around long enough that he gave Samuel L. Jackson and Denzel Washington their film debuts.
Hey, this gas fumes in here.
That means the engine's still running.
He's directed dozens of movies and television shows over the years, from Rockford Files and Starsky and Hutch to Heart of Dixie and New Girl. He was recently behind the camera directing All American and Black Lightning on the CW. But according to Schultz, growing up on Vine Street in Milwaukee in the 40s and 50s, he never dreamed of making it to Hollywood. He remembers a meager existence without refrigerators or supermarkets, spending lots of time with his grandmother while his single mother worked several jobs. A taste of country life existed in Milwaukee at the time, Schultz says, citing his grandmother's raising chickens in their yard as an example.
It wasn't in a cellophane package, all neatly cut up. You saw the chicken with his head chopped off and the thing running around, you know, and it was like almost like being on a farm in the city.
As a young boy and teenager, Schultz was an eager learner, which helped him later as a director, he says. He earned his Eagle Scout Award. He attended Riverside High School, where he played football and baseball and participated in theater productions.
I've learned a lot growing up of how to do a little bit of everything.
Schultz says his mother introduced him to opera, theater, and ballet. However, it was in the Catholic Church where Schultz began to truly understand the power of theater.
These high cathedral, you know, vaulted ceilings and the incense and the organ music and the choir singing and the priest up in front of the podium.
His love of movies comes from Saturday afternoon cliffhangers featuring Roy Rogers, Dale Evans, and Flash Gordon. They offered him his first taste of what he calls cinema energy.
It was almost like these serials that you'd see every weekend, where the hero would be in danger at the end of the episode, and you had to come back next week to see if he came out alive.
Despite those artistic influences and alluring drama, Schultz first pursued his dream of being a jet pilot or astronaut when he headed to the University of Wisconsin-Madison. After struggling with school, Schultz began to reconsider his career options. He found himself in Madison's movie theaters, watching foreign films and saying to himself, I wish I could do that.
So I'm watching movies by Fellini and Zeffirelli and Lelouch and Kurosawa and sitting in the back of the theater saying, man, these are great storytellers and great filmmaking. Way more interesting than Hollywood, you know?
He dropped out of college and went to work in a steel mill. But with the threat of being drafted into the Vietnam War looming, Schultz decided to go back to college full-time and subsequently enrolled in the theater program at Marquette University.
They didn't have a directing program, but in order to be in the theater, you had to do everything. You had to go to ballet class. You had to go to voice class. You had to go to acting class. You had to build sets or design lights or make costumes or whatever.
After graduating, he found success in New York's theater and television scenes. He eventually moved to Hollywood with hopes that his experience would get him on a big movie set. Cooley High showcases the lives and growing pains of Black Chicago teenagers in the early 1960s.
Get up, get up! Get out the bed, brother preacher. Or we gonna be late to school.
It's Friday morning. School time. You dig?
The landmark movie with the iconic Motown soundtrack continues to resonate today.
It was showing kids, Black kids, as human beings, you know? And it was funny. It was all the things that growing up that you kind of go through whether you're black or white.
Schultz says he didn't realize at the time the movie would have such a lasting impact, but he knew it would touch people. 1976's hilarious and funky Car Wash was Schultz's first of several movies with Richard Pryor. Schultz says he had a good working relationship with Pryor because they each respected each other. Pryor never did the same take twice, Schultz says, but he would do it five different ways and each would be hilarious.
And there's a good place in this world for money.
Yes, sir.
And I know where it is. It's right here in my pocket.
But what made him so accessible to everybody was his vulnerability. But people thought he was crazy and he was just super sensitive.
Music is always at the forefront of many of Schultz's movies, including Coolie High, Car Wash, and the polarizing Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band movie, starring Peter Frampton and the Bee Gees.
I get by with a little help from my friends. I get high with a little help from my friends. Yeah.
Music was also a big part of 1985's Crush Groove and The Last Dragon.
Who's badder than the Shogun?
Bruce Leroy, that too.
Bruce Leroy.
Schultz was inducted to the Black Filmmakers Hall of Fame in 1991 and has 113 directing credits to his name. Hollywood has a way of putting people in boxes, Schultz says, and after Coolie High, he was in the black comedy box. He says he fought his whole career not to be limited to that box and to do things his own way, to avoid the sausage factory approach to entertainment making.
And then there's a whole other kind of media making that is about something. It's about telling stories that impact the broader cultural conscience, that make a difference in how you see the world or how you see your fellow man, that make a difference in how you live your life.
Schultz continues to love to inspire and entertain, to make a difference through storytelling, and has no intention of stopping anytime soon.
People ask me, when are you going to retire? And I said, retire from fun? Are you kidding?
Andy Turner is a freelance journalist who lives in Milwaukee. He talked with the prolific director, Michael Schultz. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Maureen McCollum.
How do I say goodbye?
Coming up, several small towns in Wisconsin have tried to impose regulations on large industrial livestock farms. Agricultural lobbying organizations have said the towns are breaking the law. We'll get the latest. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, Wisconsin towns, including Trade Lake in Burnett County and Eureka and Lake Town in Polk County, have passed ordinances aimed at regulating large industrial livestock farms, often called concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs. There are rules on groundwater pollution, disposal of dead animals and manure, and more. The rules have gotten pushback from dairy industry lobbying organizations who say localities don't have the legal authority under state law to regulate them. The number of CAFOs around the U.S. has increased a lot in the last decade. We're talking about local attempts to regulate CAFOs and the pushback that's gotten from the industry. You can join in if this is an issue in your own community. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Diana Kruseman is Midwest Fellow at GRIST, a news outlet focused on climate change. Diana, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I mentioned a few of the communities you were reporting on. Can you talk about what is leading local officials to try to have regulations on these so-called CAFOs?
Yeah, well, these communities are very rural and have a long tradition of small farms. And the people that I talked to there really said that what's driving them is the need to preserve their water, their air, and really just the rural character of their towns. So the concerns about large animal feeding operations or CAFOs are that they release water and air pollution, and also that there's lots of noise and disturbance from trucks, you know, that are coming in and out. So they're really just concerned that having CAFOs in their areas is going to change both their environment and also just what it's like to live there.
So what kind of ordinances are these communities passing?
So the ordinances that they've passed really regulate the operations of these CAFOs. So, for example, they require the livestock operations with more than 700 animals to apply for a permit from the towns, and that they have to share their plans ahead of time to prevent the spread of infectious diseases, to contain air pollution and odors, how they're going to dispose of animal carcasses, how they're going to maintain fire safety, and how they're going to avoid damaging water resources. And the laws passed in each of these towns are slightly different, but they're all modeled on a model ordinance that was developed kind of in collaboration between these different towns.
Now, we've had multiple dairy industry lobbying groups say, hang on, you can't actually do this. What is their argument that that local governments can't do this under state law?
Well, their main argument is that there is a state law that prevents local governments from enacting stricter regulations for CAFOs than the state standards. So, for example, the state already regulates CAFOs by requiring them to have permits for waste disposal. So they're supposed to show that, you know, they're not going to pollute the waters of the state. And so as long as they meet those requirements, these CAFOs are supposed to be allowed to be sited really wherever they request to. But these towns are saying that, well, they're not actually regulating the siting of the CAFOs. They're not saying, you know, where they can and can't be located. They're just saying how their operations have to be run. And if the CAFOs aren't willing to meet those requirements in terms of providing those plans for odors and carcass disposal and things like that, then that's really on them. And it's not the towns that are regulating whether they can be located there or not.
Talking to Diana Kruseman, who's reporting for Grist. Her recent story looks at CAFOs, these larger scale livestock operations, and some small communities in Wisconsin attempting to pass and enforce regulations on them. You can join in if this is something going on in your own community at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Can you talk about the scope of CAFOs these days? Outside of these particular communities, there just are more and more of them lately, right?
Yes, that's definitely true. And this is a pattern that's been seen around the Midwest, where smaller farms have really been disappearing. And part of that is this kind of requirement to go big or get out, in that CAFOs have some advantages. You know, they are at larger scales, and so they can be more profitable. Smaller farms often just can't compete. And so in Wisconsin, which used to have 10,000 small farms, they've lost 3,000 small farms in the past a few years that have shut down due to not, you know, being able to make a profit. And so CAFOs are really kind of where farming is heading. And this is an issue that's not just in Wisconsin, but other states like Iowa and Missouri as well.
You also report that all 50 states, including Wisconsin, have passed some kind of right to farm laws. What are those?
So the idea behind those is that communities can't just say, you know, we're not going to have a farm nearby because they cause a nuisance. So, you know, everything from things like odors to noise. And the idea behind that being, you know, we don't want farmers to kind of be unfairly told where they can and can't be located. And it's supposed to support agriculture in that way. But as we can see in Wisconsin, there's a dispute over, you know, how this can be applied and whether a community saying, okay, we're not telling you where you can't be located, but we're telling you how you need to run your operations in order to protect the air and water in our community, coming up against these laws.
So here we have communities, these local communities you reported on, trying to pass these ordinances, a farming group saying, hold on, you can't do that. Who wins? Is this going to the courts now?
Yeah, so that's actually up for debate. So far, there hasn't been any legal action from these or against these towns, although they have received letters. For example, in late April, two dairy associations, the Venture Dairy Cooperative and the Wisconsin Dairy Alliance, wrote directly to Lake Town, which was the first town to pass such an ordinance. They told the town clerk that the ordinance contains at least 16 provisions that are prevented by state law and are illegal. And so there hasn't been any further action on that yet. So it remains to be seen whether that's going to go to the courts, but the towns have told me that they feel very confident in their ordinances, that they've gotten them reviewed by lawyers. It remains to be seen where that's going to go. But in other states, like in Missouri, where there's a law in 2019 that similarly to Wisconsin bars counties from issuing rules for CAFOs that are different in any way from the state's policies. Two counties actually have sued to challenge that law, and it's headed to the state Supreme Court. So depending on how things go in other states, who knows whether that will change the tide in Wisconsin as well.
You mentioned model ordinances that towns are basing these laws on. Who's created those, proposing those, and are we seeing them spread to more communities now?
Well, the one that I wrote about with these three towns in particular, it was developed by Lake Town and five other communities in 2021, which formed the Large Livestock Town Partnership. And they basically worked together to research potential problems with CAFOs, and they developed this model ordinance that individual towns could then adopt. And so three of those towns decided to adopt the ordinance. Three others are still considering it. And obviously, as we can see with the kind of response from the dairy industry, there are some potential ramifications that come with passing these ordinances, and towns have to be prepared to handle that. So some of them might not feel that they're ready to deal with legal action in that way. But this partnership is, you know, pretty unique, although there's other towns around Wisconsin that are also dealing with CAFOs. And although, you know, it's not clear what direction they're going to go, definitely there's been interest, you know, around the state in regulating CAFOs, not just in this area.
What are people in these local communities who are backing these ordinances saying about state law? Why don't they think it goes far enough to protect their local water and the other things they're concerned about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the main concerns that I heard were that state law around CAFOs doesn't at all address things like air pollution or, you know, disposal of dead animals or, you know, prevention of disease. So, for example, right now there's a nationwide avian flu outbreak. In Wisconsin in March, there was actually a farm that had to kill several million chickens because of avian flu, and ended up disposing of the bodies and creating horrible odors for neighbors nearby. So it's things like that that really concern these communities, and they're saying that state law doesn't really address that at all. And that's why they are stepping up to develop their own regulations and their own ordinances to try to protect their air and their water.
What are you watching for next on this story? It sounds like there might be a lot of steps before this gets resolved.
Yes, definitely. I think one thing I'm going to be watching for next is obviously any potential legal action or developments that happen, you know, whether these towns are going to be having to defend these ordinances in court and prove their legality. And then also whether, as you asked, other towns are going to catch on. So there's still the three other towns in this Large Livestock Town Partnership that, you know, are still considering whether to adopt these ordinances. But then all around the state, there's other communities that are concerned about this. So for example, Kennard Farms in Kewaunee County is a huge CAFO that is currently kind of locked in its own battle with the state, as it was told that it couldn't expand beyond 8,000 animals. And it's saying that actually it should be able to do that. So I'm just going to be watching, where that goes and whether that's going to influence any other decisions on CAFOs around Wisconsin.
Diana, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Diana Kruseman, Midwest News Fellow at Grist, a news outlet focused on, among other things, climate change. She talked to us about her reporting on Wisconsin towns attempting to regulate CAFOs, as we heard, with local ordinances that may, according to dairy business groups, run afoul of state law limiting their ability to do that. If this is something going on in your town or you're working on one side or another of this issue, we would love to hear from you. You can email, you can always email, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. You can follow coverage of these stories and more over at WPR.org with the Wisconsin Public Radio news team. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, wills and estate planning usually cover money and possessions. But how about words? Our guest says our emotional connections with our loved ones are worth thinking about and also worth doing now. We'll talk to a rabbi who wrote the new book, For You When I Am Gone. And if you've done something like this, a statement for your loved ones when you pass on, love to hear from you during the show, or you can get started right now. Have you ever done what's called an ethical will? Let us know. Email centraltime@WPR.org. That's centraltime@WPR.org. Also tomorrow, a new report finds that a quarter of working adults in Wisconsin are also working as caregivers for a loved one. We'll check out that survey, get advice for people juggling the two roles, and you can join in with your own experiences as a working adult, maybe working parent and caregiver for an older relative. Plus, a look at the politics of crime and how it could affect the midterm elections this year. That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll look at the role state and tribal governments play in approving gas and oil pipelines and other energy projects after a move by the Biden administration to restore their authority under the Clean Water Act. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the World Bank says stagflation could be on the horizon for the global economy. An expert explains what that is and makes the case that the risks may be overblown. First, how much power do state and tribal governments have to block federally approved energy projects if they think it puts water at risk? The Biden administration proposed regulations that would give decision-making power back to state officials and tribal authorities. If passed, the proposal would undo regulations made by the Trump administration that restricted those powers. It's all part of the Clean Water Act passed 50 years ago. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think state and tribal governments should have the authority to block federally approved pipelines and other energy infrastructure? Why or why not? Who should be in charge of letting these things happen? What questions do you have about how all of this works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Steph Tai is a law professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, researching environmental and health sciences and administrative law. Steph, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, it gets a little complicated when you get federal government, state and tribal and environmental regulation. So I kind of want to take it back to the beginning. What is the authority that was part of this Clean Air Act back in the early 1970s that's getting this back and forth treatment from the two administrations here?
Yeah, so the Clean Water Act allows for the, or requires the EPA to permit a number of different things, right? So if you're going to discharge point source pollutants, that is from a single pipe or something, into navigable waters, then you need a permit from the federal government. If you're going to do wet and filled wetlands kind of dredges, then you also need a permit from the federal government. And 401 is the permit section that allows for states
And we've lost our guest there. We'll get back into this, maybe with a different connection, looking at the Clean Water Act. And as we were just about to hear, how it regulates approval of different kinds of energy infrastructure. That includes pipelines, an issue here in Wisconsin, of course. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions or thoughts on this, 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. This is a proposed rule change from the Biden administration, overturning a Trump administration rule change that changed the way this has worked since the passage of the Clean Air Act in the early 1970s. Coming up in just a bit, we'll be looking at the global economy and a prediction, a concern from the World Bank that we could be at risk of stagflation, a combination of inflation with slow growth, something we haven't really seen since the 1970s. Right now, talking to Steph Tighe, law professor at the UW-Madison Researching Environmental Health Sciences, Researching Environmental and Health Sciences Administrative Law, looking at this proposed rule change from the Biden administration. We'll get back to this conversation in just a minute. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Steph Tighe, law professor at UW-Madison, talking about a new proposal that, if approved, would give tribes and state officials more authority, restoring that authority to block certain energy projects that could impact water sources, including pipeline projects. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have thoughts on this. If you're wondering how it works, if you're wondering, what it might mean for Wisconsin? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Steph, before we lost you there, you were just about to get to the heart of this, talking about the 401 authority and the Clean Water Act. That's the central issue here we're talking about.
Yeah, sorry about the internet issues.
That's live radio. It happens.
Right. So the 401 authority is basically allowing for states and tribes to have input into the various other type permits that the EPA or Army Corps of Engineers issues, which is basically point source pollutant discharge permits and also wetlands dredge and fill permits.
How has that authority been used over the years until it changed, at least briefly, in the Trump administration?
Yeah, so what happens is that because these different types of permits have effects on state water quality and tribal water quality, the idea was under 401 to allow states and tribes to sort of demonstrate that kind of impact and evaluate whether or not that additional kind of discharge is going to affect the water quality standards. And so prior to the Trump administration, there was a sort of more ambiguous kind of thing, basically allowing states and tribes to have a reasonable timeline to certify whether or not it would have a negative impact on state or tribal water quality, and allowing them to sort of provide either vetoes or conditions on particular types of discharges. The Trump administration found this to be an abuse of the system. There was, like, for example, Washington denied certification for a proposed coal export terminal in 2017. New York denied certification for natural gas pipeline in 2018. And so this was seen as, by the Trump administration, as an abuse of the system. And so they created this rule, basically one saying, hey, states and tribes only have a certain amount of time to object to these things. And the outer bound is 1 year. And they drew this from a DC circuit opinion. And then two, that kind of certification decision, whether or not this discharge is certified or not certified, has to be based on specific discharges from a proposed activity, not the whole overall water quality effects, and also restricts the kind of conditions that the states and tribes may impose. So it's not just about whether or not something is approved, not approved, approved, but rather also these additional conditions that are applied. So they limited that, and they also put some restrictions on how long they have to make a decision on whether or not some kind of permit application is approved.
Back in 2020, then EPA Director Andrew Wheeler said that the move was aiming to, I'm going to quote here, curb abuses of the Clean Water Act that have held our nation's energy infrastructure projects hostage and to put in place clear guidelines that finally give these projects a path forward, end quote. Was there a sense that this was, I guess, an arbitrary barrier to developing energy infrastructure?
Well, I think there was a sense from the Trump administration that it was. As I mentioned, there were a number of states that had objected to various types of proposed discharges on the basis that this would harm the water quality standards. But I think these same states and also tribes would say that, no, this is necessary to protect water quality standards. And one thing that I would mention is that the issue of water quality standards is that when states and tribes evaluate whether or not the proposed use will hinder water quality standards, they have to take into account a number of other types of water uses. So far, I mentioned dredge and fill permits and point source discharge permits. That's like, say, from a company or something or a pipeline to a particular water. But there's a lot of other things that states and tribes manage in a traditional way. For example, non-point source discharge permits or non-point source discharge in general, which is not in a permit system under the Clean Water Act, but is a large source of water pollution. For example, agricultural runoff from transportation structures, like, you know, just runoff from highways. All of these things are things that states and tribes consider when considering whether or not a potential point source discharge or wetlands fill will affect the whole overall water quality standard.
How, under this system, can states and tribal governments take into account risk? And I'm thinking here of a pipeline where if it works normally, there should be little or no discharge and pollution. But in the risk of a spill of some sort, there can suddenly be a lot. How does that factor into these decisions? How much are states and tribal governments allowed to take that risk into account?
I think that under both the Trump and Biden approach, they would be able to take into account risk. The difference between the Trump and Biden approach is that the Trump risk can only be about that potential pipeline discharge or whatever, and how that individual pipeline discharge might affect the waters. Whereas under the Biden approach and the previous approach, states and tribes can consider also the existing amount of pollution that's in the water as a result of those non-point source discharges that I mentioned, right? The cumulative effects of that discharge in addition to runoff from farmlands, runoff from highways, et cetera.
Talking to Steph Tai, law professor at UW-Madison, who researches, among other things, environmental law, looking at this rule change proposed by the Biden administration. We'll get into the process of it just a bit. It would flip back from a Trump administration change under the Clean Water Act, giving ultimately states more authority if this Biden administration rule goes through to block or put conditions on certain kinds of energy projects to take pollution and risks to water quality into effect. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about how this works? How much do states and tribal governments, do you think, have the right, or should they have the right, to stop these kind of projects or put conditions? Or if it's federally approved, should it just go ahead? Do you have concerns about the impact on energy production and flow thereof? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Steph, Wisconsin has, and neighboring states as well, have pipeline projects that are controversial. They're in the courts often. Does this rule we're talking about have much to do with what we're arguing about here in Wisconsin?
I mean, it can, in the sense that it allows for more opportunities for states and tribal governments to sort of object to particular types of uses of water. So to that extent, it does. To the extent that it affects the approval, other types of approval for, say, pipelines and stuff, somewhat, but not entirely. That is, approvals for pipelines and things are supposed to be based on an overall analysis of the environmental impacts, but also other types of legal matters, and this will affect that overall evaluation.
Now, the thing about pipelines is, of course, they're long. They go across jurisdictions from state to state and across tribal boundaries, as we know here in Wisconsin. Is part of the Trump administration rule change that would be overturned under this proposal, is part of the goal here to say we can't just let one jurisdiction block something for everybody?
Yeah, I mean, one interesting thing about this proposal is that the Biden proposal is that not only does it allow for sort of expanded or not expanded, because it's basically going back to the Obama administration approach, this more comprehensive consideration by states and tribes, but it also allows for inputs from neighboring jurisdictions, which means that it sort of looks at the sort of overall structure of the project versus an individual kind of stakeholder participation in the project.
Now, this is a proposed rule change. It's something that doesn't go through Congress. The administration puts it out there. Can you talk us through the process and the comment period and things like that that have to happen between now and this taking effect?
Yeah, so when a proposed rule is issued in the Federal Register, there's a certain number of days for comment. It's usually 60 days, although I don't remember the amount of days like available for this. But what happens is that various stakeholders, including members of the public, but including pipelines, including tribes, everyone can submit public comments. And that's something that everyone listening to here can do. And the comment process is not like, say, commenting on a newspaper article. It actually has some legal validity in the sense that if you're commenting, agencies have to take into account the substance of that comment, not necessarily each individual comment, but they have to address that in their final rule. And if they don't address that adequately, that can be overturned by a court. They need to at least take a non-arbitrary and capricious approach to all the submitted comments.
What do they end up doing with those comments? I'm guessing, is there a prospect that negative comments would lead the Biden administration to say, no, we're not going to do this after all?
Well, it might lead them to not do it after all, but it might lead them to limit what they're doing or to curtail what they're doing. I mean, this happened in the Trump kind of proposal, too. There was a period for public comments, which is required under the Administrative Procedure Act. And they didn't really narrow their approach that much, but they did address all the substance of the comments, saying, oh, we don't think this matters because X, Y, Z. That said, that's what led to their rule being stayed by a Northern California district court, which in turn ended up also being that ended up being rejected by the Supreme Court. There's a lot of stuff about that, but the sum of it is that what that means is that agencies at least need to address those kind of comments, and that will be taken into consideration by courts in any kind of legal challenge.
And speaking of courts, now under the rule that we would go back to under the Biden administration, if this goes ahead, say I'm a pipeline company and I've gotten my federal approval. And then a state or tribal government says, no, we're looking at it under our standards. It's back off the table, or we're going to impose these conditions on you. Do I have a recourse? Is there a court? Can I go into court and say, no, state, your regulations are too difficult. They're unreasonable.
Well, I think first they would need to challenge if this rule comes into place, they would need to challenge that rule in the first place as arbitrary and capricious. And so they would first need to get that rule rejected so that the whole process that the EPA has now designed is rejected. Then if that rule doesn't get rejected, they can still challenge in a more limited basis that determination by the tribe that this kind of violates water quality standards. That's a more subsequent kind of evaluation.
In just our last couple minutes, bigger picture, we see administrations on a lot of environmental issues doing a back and forth. A Republican changes a thing, a Democrat changes a back, a Republican, and so on. How much of that have you seen in the transition from the Trump administration to the Biden administration?
It's been absolutely a lot. And I've noticed that in a number of different rules. One thing I wanted to point out is that the Biden administration actually did encapsulate one of the Trump administration's things, sort of. So one of the things that the Trump administration did with this 401 rule is that they said, okay, we're going to have a maximum time limit for states and tribes to decide on the water quality certification process of up to 1 year. And the Biden administration actually kind of took that. What they said, and I thought this was really interesting, and I think this is what they're basing their economic value of this rule on, is that they said, okay, we're going to do two things. We're going to say, look, we're going to have states and tribes consult with the EPA and decide negotiatively on what time and time frame it's necessary to evaluate this kind of proposal. which suggests that it can go before a year or it can be up over a year, which is different from the Trump administration because they had a maximum of 1 year. And this means that if the states and the EPA decide that it's too complicated and it's going to take over a year to do that, they can do it. But it also says that if the EPA and the state or tribe doesn't agree on the time frame, then the default is going to be 60 days, which is a much more limited process. And so what happens is it seems to and then the state or tribe would have to apply for extension with a written kind of process. So what it seems to do is it seems to speed up some kind of areas for permit applications and then maybe slow down other areas. And so it's a really interesting kind of approach. We'll see how the administration applies that. But I think it's actually, it's not entirely different from the Trump administration's approach.
Now, this is all basically executive action, rulemaking authority granted, in this case, under the Clean Water Act by Congress. Have we seen Congress dig back into some of these early 70s environmental regulations and clarify or change things or limit or expand this kind of authority for the executive branch?
Alas, they have not. I mean, there's been even calls from the Supreme Court to sort of expand that, for example, with the actual reach of the Clean Water Act, which is one of the issues before the Supreme Court this next fall. But it hasn't been something that Congress has addressed. I know that the Obama administration initially said that they were going to push for addressing, say, the overall jurisdiction of the Clean Water Act and various other elements with it, and they didn't really go very far on this.
What are some of the other big environmental stories that you are watching for between Congress, the president, and, of course, the courts, the Supreme Court weighing in on some of these issues?
Yeah, I think the thing that I mentioned just now is going to be before the court. The briefing was over the summer, and I have to disclose that I was part of an amicus group representing water scientists in favor of the Biden administration. But the main thing is that there's a case before the Supreme Court about the reach of the Clean Water Act in terms of what wetlands kind of permits are allowable under the Clean Water Act. Is it wetlands that just directly touch surface waters? Is it wetlands that are connected in some kind of more seasonal way? All of that stuff. So that's something that's going to be a big determination, and it's going to carve out either carve out a bunch of wetlands from the scope of the Clean Water Act, still allowing them to be permitted through state systems, or it's going to sort of limit the reach of the Clean Water Act.
And how big an impact could that have if that, I think they're sometimes called intermittent waters, if those protections, if the court rules, they don't apply?
Yeah, so the scientists that that my team represents is that it will actually affect, like, compared to the Obama/Biden approach, the Trump approach would limit it by a fairly significant amount. I think like 30 or 40% would reduce it, the coverage of the Clean Water Act.
Steph, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
That's Steph Tai, law professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, researching environmental and health sciences and administrative law. Been talking about the impact of a recently announced proposal by the Biden administration that would give some authority back to state and tribal governments when making decisions about blocking pipelines, among other energy-related projects that require federal approval. Coming up after the news, the World Bank says we may be in for stagflation in the coming years when economic growth slows down at the same time that inflation goes up. Our guest isn't so sure about that prediction, though. We'll find out what it means, why it could or could not happen, and as always, welcome your calls along the way. Remember, you can follow these conversations all the time, anytime, online at WPR.org or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. On both of those, you can stream the Ideas Network live and check out our archives and coverage from the WPR news team as well. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.